Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with an argument that President Obama should go to Congress to make his case for war against Syria. Award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic, James Fellows, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, "Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress," and that there is more on the line than a president's credibility when it comes to war. Then we'll look into what is happening at the UN as a repeat of the Iraq experience appears to be underway, with calls to allow UN weapons inspectors time to do their job before the bombing begins. Barbara Cassette, the UN correspondent for The Nation and the former New York Times bureau chief at the UN, joins us to discuss efforts by the British to draft a resolution based on the R2P doctrine, the responsibility to protect, that would allow military action in Syria based on humanitarian grounds that civilians need to be protected from the regime's use of WMDs. Then finally, we'll speak with Colonel Andrew Bacevich, a retired U.S. Army colonel who is currently a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. We will discuss his article at BillMoyers.com, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger, and the reality that only 9% of Americans support a war against Syria, as well as the fact that from a soldier's perspective, war is a risky business. And joining us now is James Fellow, who is an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate, and he's also the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book is China Airborne. He has an article at The Atlantic, Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Ian, it's nice to talk to you again.
And your wild idea, of course, is how business was done for most of the, 200-plus years of the Republic. But it certainly has not been the convention of late, has it?
It has not been. And you can understand one practical reason why presidents have not gone to Congress, which is there are certain circumstances that are so fast-breaking, et cetera, that the executive needs the ability to respond quickly. But I think when there is a well-advertised, coldly calculated, punitive, as we're hearing it, strike being contemplated, then I think there is both democratic and political advantage and compelling advantage for President Obama to involve the Congress rather than just doing this himself.
Well, of course, the British have done exactly that. Now, maybe now Cameron regrets doing it because he got quite a backlash. And Jack Straw, the architect of the Iraq War, not the architect of the Iraq, but the foreign minister during the Iraq War with Tony Blair, has voiced his reservations. And now they're going to have another vote because the parliament said basically we're not going to vote on this until the evidence is in from the UN, and that won't be completed until Saturday. That seems to be, in terms of this red line, it does seem that nothing's going to happen until Saturday.
It is so strange that we're talking in these sort of hourly or daily predictions about impending military action, both in terms of the traditional military concept, if you're going to do something, you do it by surprise, and in terms of the democratic concept that we're just assuming something happening without a full contemplation by the political process. I think the UK example shows both why President Obama is avoiding going to Congress, but also why he should go to Congress. And now I'll just spend 30 seconds laying out that scenario. Let's assume for purposes of discussion that the U.S., the Britain, the French, whatever, feel they need to enforce this so-called red line against chemical weapons use, and that the punitive raids work better than any other military actions in history. Even if they work extremely well, there are going to be things that go wrong. There will be innocent people who die. There will be collateral damage. There are things that no one foresees. Recall that the U.S. mistakenly bombed the Chinese embassy in the Balkans during a similar campaign in 1999 to over Kosovo. And so it is in the political interest of the regimes in both countries, both the Cameron government in the UK and the Obama administration here, to get some to share the political responsibility for what is what may be a success, but has a lot of will certainly have some unwholesome aspects too. Also, as a matter of democracies, democracies are supposed to decide democratically on acts of war. So I think it is good for the country and also good for both Barack Obama and David Cameron to involve the political process in this decision.
And James Follows, so much in international relations has been driven by leaders' sense of their own credibility. You recall Henry Kissinger's reluctance to end the war in Vietnam, even though it was a manifest failure, because our credibility was shot, and that the Russians would suddenly think, or the Soviets would suddenly not take us seriously, which of course was ridiculous because they were enjoying the fact that we were wasting our lives and treasure, and we paid them back by when they got embroiled in Afghanistan. So I don't understand how leaders equate their own credibility with a nation's need to go to war.
I agree with you on this, and I think this is probably it's one of the two or three parallel strands we need to address here. One of those strands is whether, entirely apart from what Barack Obama said last year about the red line involving chemical weapons, whether there is a shared international interest in defending the so-called norm against the use of chemical weapons. I personally disagree with the argument that it's worth getting involved in Syria for that reason, but that is one part of it. The second and different strand is the idea that precisely because Barack Obama said there is this red line, and only because he said that, therefore the U.S. is required to make good on that threat. Otherwise, it will look like some kind of hollow figure on the world stage. My observation of political history and world history is that credibility in the long run depends on demonstrating a clear-eyed, long-term view of your rational interests and your rational ideals, and not defending something just because you got backed into a corner for it. I think that makes you look weak and outmaneuvered rather than credible. And I don't think, for example, the continuation of the bombing campaign in Vietnam long ago did anything to enhance U.S. credibility. So if President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron really believe that for interests of world peace and nonproliferation in the long run, they must attack Syria, that's one thing. If they're doing this just because President Obama drew this line, then I think that is foolish, and I hope that is not the grounds for going ahead.
And again, I'm speaking with James Follows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate, and he's the former editor of U.S. News and World Report. And his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book is China Airborne. He has an article at The Atlantic, Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress. Now, in terms of the UN, it does seem, James Follows, that the British are trying to lead the way in crafting a resolution to present to a paralyzed UN Security Council, where Russia and China routinely veto any resolutions to punish Assad. So that is a given, but there is this concept and doctrine called R2P, responsibility to protect, and that seems to be the rubric under which the British are floating their resolution. So what do you think? I mean, the latest rumors coming out of the White House is that they're planning to do a shot across the bow. So they seem to want to separate the Syrian war from but you can understand that mental slip. They want to separate the Syrian war from the need to punish Syria for the crossing the line on WMD. So what's your sense of not just addressing Congress, but also what Samantha Power and Susan Rice, both of who are big proponents of R2P, should be doing?
Again, first we should say nobody knows what is going to happen. It's possible that all of the rumors we're hearing out of London, Washington, are being very deliberately, but not they're being deliberately leaked in our smokescreen operations. So we don't know that. We do pretty much know that the UN Security Council will not approve any action on Syria because of the different interests of both Russia and China. China, with its doctrine of non-intervention, Russia as an effective ally of Syria. I think I think the administration in the U.S. is in an awkward position presenting either of these cases. If it's making the obligation to protect, requirement to protect case, then the question is, well, what about the last year in which 100,000 people or so were killed? And where does this responsibility end, et cetera, et cetera? So it would be strange to advance that argument only now, when several hundreds of people as opposed to tens of thousands have been killed. On the punitive grounds, saying that there is a norm, there have to be consequences for crossing this line, there is by definition no rush about inflicting that penalty. It's not a time-sensitive thing, and so I think the burden, the advantage would be on the U.S. both to make the case to its own political leadership and to make the case internationally, saying we recognize the United Nations is paralyzed here, it disagrees. We, in our capacities as Western nations, believe there's something we have to do, and so this is the case. You know, I disagree with that, but I think the most effective way to proceed would be to explain why the United Nations can't work and say, this is exactly what we're doing, why we're doing it. And then there's one other complication I will filibuster on about here. There is a very difficult middle ground the administration in the U.S. is trying to occupy. On the one hand, it wants to do something that is not so trivial that it has no effect at all. On the other hand, it doesn't want to do something that is so large then just ensures retaliation, further U.S. engagement, et cetera. So that middle ground between something strong enough that Assad notices and pays a price and small enough that he doesn't respond in some escalating way, that may be a very, very small territory to occupy.
So, James Fellows, the last time any president went to Congress in advance of a war was George H.W. Bush in advance of the first Gulf War, where he sought approval and got it. There are similar circumstances in as much as an unsavory dictator had crossed the line and invaded a country. And I'm sure the president could make the case that another unsavory dictator has crossed the line to the Congress. Given the gridlock there in Washington, just him showing up at Congress, to my mind, wouldn't be a bad idea, let alone getting this resolution.
I agree. And actually, there is one more unsettling example, which is that after the 9/11 attacks, actually, George W. Bush did get from Congress the so-called authorization for use of military force, which has essentially been the blanket for everything that has happened thereafter. And Obama himself has pointed out that this is too sweeping. We have to get out of this era of open-ended war. But I think that given Obama's history, his political history of talking about the proper constitutional balance, his personal history as a constitutional lawyer, his political situation now as somebody who is criticized both on the right and the left for the endless expansion of executive power, I think it would be in his enlightened self-interest and that of the country for him formally to make a case as opposed to just going on TV and saying, as I speak, bombs are dropping.
So what are the chances then? I mean, what do you hear? You're there in Washington with your ear to the ground. I mean, one of the things I find extraordinary about this is that, you know, Putin has been very silent on this, but the U.S. and Russia really do have a common interest here in Syria, which is neither country wants al-Qaeda to take over. And the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front seems to be the most effective military force on the rebel side. And if you empower them and they take over, that's a nightmare for the U.S. And the Russians also share that nightmare, with the Caucasus only being 500 miles away. So I'm just surprised that there's not more common interest here in making this peace conference work, given that the intractable nature of the two sides.
Everything you say makes sense to me, and so this is one of many imponderables. And I find myself unable to predict with any confidence what's going to happen. Certainly over the last 20 years, you would think this kind of buildup in Washington would virtually ensure a military action. I'm struck this time that over the past week there's been more resistance than I would have expected. You know, usually it's the case that all of these serious figures in the press are making pro-military arguments because just by definition they seem more legitimate and grown up. There's been from the Congress, from both parties, from people in, you know, both each of the parties is split on this. The Republicans have their neocon and libertarian type factions. The Democrats have their liberal hawk and non-liberal hawk faction. So there's been more resistance than I expected, and I just don't know what we'll be seeing a week's time from now.
Well, I think what's underlying that reality is a poll that says only 9% of the United of the people in this country want to go to war in Syria.
Yes.
That's pretty extraordinary.
And that, you could say that a country that over the last 12 years has been sapped and economically, physically, in many other ways by essentially endless war, that there is at least the check in the democratic system to say, do we need another one?
Well, James Fellows, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with James Fellows. He's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Slate. He's also a former editor of U.S. News and World Report, and his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress, Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest book is China Airborne. He also has an article at The Atlantic, Here's a Wild Idea About Syria, Make the Case to Congress. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into what is happening at the UN. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barbara Cassette, who is a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, the author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later the Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She's also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. In 2010-2011, Ms. Cassette reported and wrote the State of the World Population Reports for the United Nations Population Fund, the first focused on women in the post-conflict areas and the second on the world at 7 billion. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barbara Cassette.
Thank you.
And obviously things have moved to the United Nations. There's a sort of deja vu about this, given the build-up to the Iraq War, in the sense that there's Ban Ki-moon is pleading to give peace a chance, to wait, not to fight, but to talk, give diplomacy a chance. I believe that the UN inspectors won't be finished until Saturday. What's your sense at what's happening at the United Nations here, given the expectation that Russia and China would veto any Security Council resolution to authorize force against Syria?
Well, until, of course, we hear what the weapons inspectors, and these are good independent experts, come back with, it's sort of hard to tell where the UN will move next. And as we've talked about before, when you say UN, you're really talking about the Security Council, because the Secretary General can say whatever he wants, but, you know, the big powers will decide. An interesting thing happened yesterday, and I think this reflects some thinking in the UN. Lakhdar Brahimi, who is the UN and the Arab League's envoy on this issue of Syria, who's now moved to Geneva in the hope of convening talks later, had a press conference yesterday, and he said something very interesting. Brahimi is, I think, one of the great diplomats of a generation, a former Algerian foreign minister who speaks, you know, Arabic and French and English flawlessly and just goes from one to another. He had a lot of trouble in the past with American administrations, Clinton administration, and certainly George W. Bush over the use of force. Yesterday at this news conference, he just threw a line away that has hardly ever been reported anywhere today that I've seen. He said, as he understands, that Obama is not trigger happy, and he used that phrase in English, trigger happy. So he feels that, you know, that first of all, he's communicating with Washington, which wasn't always the case. They tried to give him orders in the past when he was working with Kofi Annan. So if that's his sense, that the U.S. can probably wait till Saturday. This is important for the UN and for the U.S. because, as everyone knows, in the Second Iraq War, George Bush literally ordered George W. Bush ordered the weapons inspectors out of Iraq. They did still have questions to ask. They did still have things to examine, and basically told them to get lost. Then overrode a Security Council refusal to authorize this, and simply went to war. This created a huge amount of bad will for the United States all around the world, and certainly in the Arab world. Now, if they build a case over a longer period of time, as George Bush won, the father did, with the Gulf Coalition, this may not be so bad. So, in other words, I think everybody is saying, what's wrong with waiting till Saturday? If the evidence has been collected, some of it is gone, some of it will never be able to be determined, you know, what's the rush? And I think this sense tends to be the sense of it. As you know, the Security Council has had a resolution tabled by Britain, or introduced by Britain would be a better word, and it's going nowhere at the moment. The British Parliament backed off a debate yesterday. Today they're actually discussing this. But again, the shadow of Iraq in many ways hangs over this. So how this is handled by the U.S., Iraq is very much in memory. And so the feeling is, you know, if the U.S. can sit still for a little while until the evidence is in from the U.N., then a lot of critics won't feel the same way, and the U.N. will be on, the U.S. would be on firmer ground, whether or not you think there should be military action. I think this is interesting because the atmosphere is very different than the atmosphere that was created by Bush and people like John Bolton.
Again, I'm speaking with Barbara Cassett, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine. She was formerly the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia, and was the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Now, the president in an interview with PBS said, "I have no interest in any kind of open-ended conflict in Syria, but we do have to make sure that when countries break international norms on weapons like chemical weapons that could threaten us, that they are held accountable." So it seems that from the beginning the administration has separated the war in Syria, the civil war in Syria, from crossing the line over the use of WMD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my understanding is that the British and other diplomats on the UN Security Council are trying to sort of talk about this in terms of a humanitarian disaster, and suggesting that this military action would be a way to protect civilians from another humanitarian disaster brought on by weapons of mass destruction. So is that the way that they're trying to finesse this?
Yeah, this is interesting, and you probably heard and noticed today the French are kind of backing away a little bit from what was a slightly more hawkish pose a few days ago. But for the British today released two very interesting documents. The Joint Intelligence Committee's sort of survey of the situation from an intelligence standpoint. But the other one, it's interesting, and this goes to your point. The other one is basically the British government's reasoning for why military action, I shouldn't say war, military action could be undertaken. And in all the three conditions, it says a legal basis is available under the doctrine of humanitarian intervention provided by three conditions. And every one of those conditions mentions humanitarianism, extreme humanitarian distress on a large scale, no practicable alternative to the use of force if lives are to be saved, and proportionate to the aim of relief of human need and suffering, and so on. So, you know, that they're building their entire case, at least officially, in these documents released today in Britain.
Well, this, of course, is the doctrine that Samantha Power and others are famous for, is it not?
Yeah, that's right. And even more recently, interest in this responsibility to protect doctrine, which was adopted by UN member nations in the General Assembly, which means the majority of countries in the world in 2005, the responsibility to protect has a lot of ifs, ands, and buts in it. But it's often quoted as a reason. And there was a huge argument after the invasion or the military action in Libya about whether this was a responsibility to protect. It's called R2P by the people who talk about it. That had gone horribly wrong, and it became regime change. And not just Russia, but India was violently against this whole process being tried elsewhere because they saw it as a wedge. You call it the responsibility to protect or humanitarian intervention or whatever you want. Next thing you know, you have a new government. And, a lot of countries in the world don't like that precedent.
So how Barbara Crissett, again, the UN correspondent for The Nation magazine and formerly New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations, how do you see Samantha Power handling this job? She was actually on vacation. She had to come back because of this crisis. I met with her some years back, and she struck me as being extremely bright, but in a somewhat academic way. She certainly doesn't have the experience of a Thomas Pickering. How is she handling the job?
Well, it's been awfully short. I mean, just a matter of weeks, if that. And then she did go on vacation. She's been in the Security Council. I know there have been reports in the media that she's taking instructions directly from the National Security Council in Washington about how far to go, how bold to be, and all those other things, and what to commit the United States to.
But that's how business is always done anyway, isn't it?
Exactly. But, there were people who thought that because she was so outspoken and so overpoweringly vocal on this question of genocide, humanitarian crises, and so on, that she would be a little bit of a freelance operator. And I guess it's just far too soon to judge her. I haven't noticed anybody saying that, she's in any way getting outside the American line. Now, if the Security Council starts some real backdoor bargaining and so on, that would be a huge test of her diplomatic skills, of which she has no track record.
Well, but Susan Rice, who's ostensibly her boss in the sense that she would be issuing the orders or what to say and what not to say, they're on the same page with R2P, aren't they? Susan Rice is the person who was haunted by the Clinton administration's lack of action to stop the Rwanda genocide.
That's right. And Susan Rice is not a person who likes to be upstaged. That was clear when she was in the job that Samantha Power now has. So Susan Rice also has to establish herself as a strong and credible and sort of better than good national security advisor in this particular kind of situation. So, I don't think there necessarily would be any tension. We all remember that picture of the two of them with their arms around each other and Obama walking out of the White House Rose Garden after their appointments. So, I mean, they do, but, Washington is Washington, and people can get extremely thin-skinned, and people can worry about their own positions. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Because, I was there during the time Madeleine Albright and Richard Holbrooke could barely tolerate the sight of each other. And yet there was really nothing different about the way they felt on numerous issues.
Well, but when you talk about the personalities and people feeling the need to assert themselves and to lay down the red line as the president has done, it's a pity in many ways that he didn't lay that red line down in a more less unilateral way by saying if the line is crossed, this will have to invoke the UN and et cetera, et cetera. He's basically drawn the line in the sand that more or less says that the United States is the international humanitarian cop on the beat.
Right. Well, this is another one of those things that was supposed to have happened between Washington and New York in the U.S. mission over last weekend. At the end of last week, he was interviewed by Chris Cuomo on a CNN program, and he did say something about waiting for the UN or getting the UN behind us, meaning, of course, the Security Council. And then on, and the implication was waiting for the UN inspectors to come to some conclusions while they were being, you know, sort of dawdled around in Syria by the government. Anyway, but the report after that was that he's never said that since, and that sort of people closed around him and said, don't say we're waiting for the UN. This doesn't go down in the United States and certainly doesn't go down in Congress, which is another whole story about what happened to the UN's reputation during the Iraq War in the United States political system.
Well, also, I imagine that psychologically they want to put as much pressure on Assad as possible.
Yes. Oh, no. Oh, absolutely. But as I said, you know, it's sort of different. I mean, it's different than the tension before the Iraq, even the earlier Iraq attacks in the 90s when the U.S. was bombing. They bombed at one point various offices in Baghdad and people there. I was there in 98. People said, I mean, they practically could choose the file drawer on some of these things and get rid of the, you know, what they wanted to get rid of in the weapons program. So, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of, and I think there's almost less tension now. I'm not in Damascus, so I'm sure the people there are quite concerned. And obviously the Israelis are concerned. And Lebanon, you know, always gets sort of stomped over, like when the elephant crosses the fields, you know, and so there are lots of neighbors. But Turkey is being pretty belligerent, at least a few days ago, on this. And so, you know, it's interesting to see. But, Obama surely wasn't counting on having a second term battling another Middle Eastern war or military action. And in a way, he's, as I said, on a learning curve himself.
So Barbara Cassett again, UN correspondent for The Nation magazine and formerly the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. Do you think that there's a consensus, at least amongst the French and the British and the Turks and the Americans, about simply being fed up with Assad? I mean, as much as many voices on the left make excuses for Assad and for Gaddafi, in this case, I think it's fair to say that Assad brought most of this tragedy that's destroyed his country on himself because he's a dictator, and so was Gaddafi, and that dictators destroy countries, they destroy any possibility of a political alternative. So you can't expect people, you know, one, you can expect people to rise up, but on the other hand, you can't expect democracy to flourish immediately. There's a huge vacuum because people have been lobotomized and the opposition has been eradicated. And this guy's had any number of chances to mediate, but instead he's decided to go, it's all or nothing, and to exterminate the opposition rather than negotiate with them. So that has been pretty clear all along. It's also pretty clear that it's much more likely that the regime has chemical weapons, and it's extremely unlikely that the rebels have them. You have to do a lot of mental gymnastics to figure out how these ragtag, 2,400 little bands of rebels could have gotten hold of WMD. So is that a subtext here? Are people just fed up with Assad?
Oh, I think people are astonished on one hand that he let this happen. I mean, this is, of course, the legacy of his father, you know, who went out and murdered, I forgot how many people in the city of Hama, when he was in power. And so the idea of annihilation being a policy of dealing with political opposition is not new. But I think astonished one and horrified that he would really do this. And you know, it's hard to believe that it could have been the rebels. In the joint intelligence report that the British government released today, or whatever they released of it, I mean, it's a clear sentence. There is no credible intelligence or other evidence to substantiate the claims of the possession of CW, chemical weapons, by the opposition. The JIC, that's the Joint Intelligence Committee, has therefore concluded there are no plausible alternative scenarios to regime responsibility. So that's laid out as British policy.
Well, the fact that Putin has been silent on this
Yeah.
would indicate to me that maybe Putin knows that his side screwed up. And that, you know, the theories, one of the theories is that, of course, that the brother Maher did it and, you know, Assad didn't necessarily approve of it, but it's too late now.
Yeah, this is interesting. I don't know how you feel about this, but those of us outside the intelligence sort of, you know, insider networks are amazed at how little is known about the sort of inner relationships in that regime, and also whether there are other shadowy people in the military who may be, you know, taking on themselves some responsibility for some of these things. It's very hard to tell. And as an outsider or as a consumer of information, and I don't see very much of it coming out even now. That will have to come later. No, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, people are not only fed up, but as I said, just scandalized and horrified that, you know, that a country that was, you know, coming along reasonably, I mean, it had no political opposition, should do this. I mean, Mubarak never did anything like this. And neither did Ben Ali in Tunisia, and on this scale and with this kind of horror show. And so along comes Syria, and it just astonishes everyone. Now, whether, and you know, even Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, has said, we really want a political solution, which would indicate that they know, a lot of the Russians know that, but they can't deliver Assad at all. And so this is, you know, doubly awful. And today, you know, the president of France also said that the only way out of this is a political solution. Well, you know, there's a problem there. And Assad may bring down his own regime and maybe his death if he refuses to acquiesce to that. I think we all think American military action in the short term and British or Turkish or whatever would be pinpoint. It wouldn't be, you know, there's no invasion or anything like that. It'd be hard to invade anyway, because what would you do? But to knock out, you know, chemical plants, defense establishment places, a no-fly zone, maybe shoot down aircraft. I mean, that, which is what they did in Libya, you know, is probably what they're thinking about. And again, I go back to my original point that, well, can't this wait 3 days? You know, and then once the UN says something, and then a lot of people, the wind will come out of a lot of sails. And you know, all those people you talked about, left-wing opponents of these military actions, are actually anti-war people. And in some ways, the anti-war people are as ignorant of what is, or you know, willfully not paying attention to what the reasons are for this in humanitarian terms, as are ignorant the people on the right wing who just want to go over there and lay waste to Syria and not understand the consequences in the neighborhood. So, you know, there's a lot of hot talk on both sides. But I do think a lot of the people protesting today in Britain, and it will eventually happen outside the UN, or it will happen in Washington, are just anti-war. I mean, they're anti-involvement in another Middle East conflict.
Well, so is the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon. I mean, he's saying, give peace a chance, give diplomacy a chance, stop fighting and start talking.
Right.
Who can argue with that?
No, well, Kofi Annan said that also. And, you know, even before him, Boutros Ghali got into trouble for various things. You know, they're long, old stories. But, you know, but Ban Ki-moon is known to be much more of a compromiser if you're really critical of him. But I think conciliator and consensus seeker is maybe what he would think he is.
Well, Barbara Cassette, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barbara Cassette, who's a writer on international affairs and the United Nations correspondent at The Nation magazine, the author of several books on Asia. She was the New York Times chief correspondent in Southeast Asia and South Asia from 1984 to 1991, and later became the New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations. She's also been a diplomatic correspondent in Washington and a reporter in Central America, the Caribbean, and Canada. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a retired U.S. Army colonel who has questions for President Obama before he pulls the trigger. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colonel Andrew Basevich, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel and currently a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. His books include American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, and his latest book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. He has an article at BillMoyers.com, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger on Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Basevich.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And the latest reports from the White House indicate that we're talking about a shot across the bow. What does that mean in military terms?
Well, I'm just going by what I read in the papers, and it appears that it's going to be a relatively brief sequence of strikes by cruise missiles launched from U.S. naval vessels off the coast of Syria. So the principal weapon system, apparently, is going to be a Tomahawk cruise missile mounting, of course, a conventional warhead. Speculation seems to be that this could go on for a couple days, maybe 3 days.
And I imagine it won't start till after Saturday when the UN inspectors have completed their work in inspecting the residue of an apparent chemical weapons use in the suburbs of Damascus.
Well, I mean, it depends on what the target set is. I'm speculating here, but I imagine that the chemical weapons inspectors are at the site of this awful event that occurred. Doesn't necessarily mean that that's a target. Target could be launch sites, target could be storage facilities, could be communications facilities. I'm sure that the Pentagon doesn't want to kill weapons inspectors, but I don't know that their presence at the scene of the crime, as it were, necessarily precludes the United States from acting. We'll just have to see.
But Colonel Andrew Basevich, this does appear to be a political use of military force as opposed to a military use, if you will, of military force. Would you agree?
I think that's precisely correct. My view would be that the politics that are driving this are domestic politics, that the president got himself into a bit of a fix when he announced that chemical weapons use by the Syrian government constituted a red line, and he is embarrassed by the fact that the red line has been crossed, and he's not done anything. And this has attracted a huge amount of criticism. He's now being accused. I think the whole thing is bogus, but he's being accused of forfeiting American credibility, and therefore the pressure is on for him to act in order to restore that credibility. And I think that's basically what this is all about, helping the president get himself out of the corner in which he put himself in by an ill-considered remark.
And preceding you on this program, Colonel Basevich, was James Fellows, the national correspondent for The Atlantic. He makes the case that the president should go to Congress and make his case for war. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this claim, certainly not original with President Obama, that the president, in his role as commander-in-chief, has the authority to order attacks like this is completely wrongheaded and is at a minimum consistent with the spirit of the Constitution, and I think is in violation of the letter of the Constitution. I mean, certainly if the United States is under direct assault by some forces, the president wouldn't need to go to the Congress to get permission to attack or to use military forces to defend the country. But we're not talking about that kind of a situation. Syria poses no threat to the United States, and therefore, to go by the literal reading of the Constitution, he ought to go to the Congress and get congressional authorization to go to war, because that's in fact what we seem to be intent on doing.
So, as a military man or a former military man, Colonel Basevich, how does the military execute the president's orders here when you have this sort of ambiguity about the use of force, where on the one hand, too little won't send the kind of signal that they want or will look like, you know, a slap on the wrist, and too much might trigger a wider war?
Well, it's a balancing act. If we go by the views expressed by General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the senior most officer on active duty, it's pretty clear that actually the military doesn't want to have anything to do with a possible war in Syria. I mean, Dempsey sent a letter to a member of Congress about 10 days ago that was quite clear on that. Nonetheless, Dempsey and the rest of the military, they know that the commander-in-chief, in fact, is that. They follow the president's orders. It's entirely appropriate that they should do so, even if the president is acting stupidly or inappropriately. We want civilian control to be sacrosanct. I would imagine that the officer corps, the senior members of the officer corps, find some consolation in the fact that the attack is going to be a limited one. I mean, were the president proposing to send in U.S. ground troops? Were he proposing an air campaign intended to overthrow President Assad? Then I suspect the military doubts would be much greater. But at least if we go by what we're reading in the press, what the president is asking the military to do is to fling a few dozen tomahawks from offshore and have done with it. So the risk to U.S. forces, the risk of being dragged into something much bigger and much longer doesn't seem to be that great.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Andrew Basevich, who is a retired U.S. Army colonel and currently a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. His books include American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, and his latest book is Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. He has an article at BillMoyers.com, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger on Syria. Now, of course, Israel has done these strikes. They haven't been punitive strikes. They've been targeted strikes against what the Israelis say were transfers of sophisticated ground-to-air missiles from the Syrian inventory to the Hezbollah. But the Israelis are calling up their reservists. So, you know, that may well be a caution because it's a dangerous neighborhood and it's about to get more dangerous. But on the other hand, you can't help noticing the silence from Vladimir Putin. Some people suggest that his silence is based upon the fact that he knows that the Assad regime did actually use these weapons, and either through a breakdown of command and control or because the crazy brother Maher had a fit, whatever the reasons are. But one of the things that strikes me, Colonel Basevich, that I wish there was more discussion about, and that is how much the U.S. and Russia have in common in Syria. Neither side wants al-Qaeda to take over, and we know that the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front is the most effective rebel force, and if they win, then we'll have, you know, Somalia on the Mediterranean, and the Russians argue the same. And they say, where, you know, the Caucasus are only 500 miles away from where this jihadi the new jihadi university is underway.
Well, you're right, I think, that were the driver of U.S. policy in this instance security, national security policy, if that's really what was driving the train, then it might be possible for the U.S. and Russia to collaborate to some degree. But as I suggested earlier, it's not security considerations that drive in the train. It's in my judgment at least, it's U.S. domestic politics. So we, in effect, however indecisively, we are going to act in ways that will advance the cause of the radical Islamists who are intent on overthrowing Assad. despite the fact that, as you say, if and when they succeed, it's quite likely that we're going to be not only unhappy with the outcome, but we'll probably end up seeing Syria as more of a problem than it has been under the Assad regime, or frankly, more of a problem than it is even when Syria is torn asunder by this civil war. But none of that matters, given the primacy of domestic politics in the crisis.
But in your article, Colonel Basevich, at BillMoyes.com, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger on Syria, you ask these questions, which, you know, one would hope somebody's asking the president. And I think, to be fair to Obama, he's not George W. Bush. I think he's much more thoughtful, and he's certainly not Dick Cheney. And I recall that when the U.S. did go into Iraq, shortly thereafter, the Iranians sent through emissaries basically said, we want to talk. They thought they might be next. And that moment of leverage was thrown away because Cheney basically said, we don't talk to evil. Now, you do have, you know, not similar, but, you know, a situation not entirely dissimilar, where you have a moment of maximum leverage before you go bombing, and nobody knows how bad the bombing is going to be. So presumably Assad's concerned. So I would wonder why we're not exploiting this moment of leverage to get some kind of deal to have a peace talk.
You're making a powerful argument, and I'm repeating myself, and it's my view that decisions are being driven by considerations that actually are not connected to long-term policy, that president's in a fix, and the chemical weapons usage, and I agree it probably was done by somebody in the Assad regime, in a sense provided him with the opportunity to fix the problem, to demonstrate that when he draws a red line, he really means it, therefore to get his domestic critics to back off as he makes a show of restoring American credibility. My view would be that if the United States lacks credibility, it's not because the president drew a red line and then didn't enforce it. If the United States lacks credibility, it's because of all of the ill-conceived and bungled policies of the past couple of decades that have resulted in the misuse of American military power. That's the problem. The problem is not what the Assad regime has done in the last 10 days or so.
Well, there is, though, the fact that only 9% of the American people support a war against Syria. It feels as if many in the press and many in our political class are in completely disconnected from that fundamental reality, the wisdom of the American people.
I think you're exactly right. But, you know, from the perspective of that class that you just referred to, the American people are not wise. Within Washington, the perception is that the American people are feckless, that they have isolationist tendencies, that they're too willing to call it quits and go home. And from that perspective, the polls indicating popular opposition to any kind of conflict with Syria don't much matter. Now, they might matter if we had some sort of a significant election in the next 2 weeks or the next 2 months. But we're out of the election cycle right now, and therefore it becomes easier for people in Washington to disregard what popular opinion has to say.
So in your article at BillMoyes.com, Andrew Basevich, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger on Syria, you point out that war is a risky business. So from a soldier's perspective, surely you know and how much the best-laid plans don't work, how much Murphy's Law comes into play. If we look at a similar example with the Bosnian War, where the U.S. bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, infuriating the Chinese, that's collateral damage. I mean, there may be some ambiguity. Maybe, you know, there were reports that the Milosevic and his wife were hiding out there, but the long and the short of it is, it's, the assumption has always been that that was an accident. So isn't that inherent in war?
It is. And I imagine that the General Dempsey and other senior military officers are quite conscious. They ought to be conscious of the risks involved because they've experienced them at first hand in the Iraq War and the Afghanistan and so on. That said, a limited cruise missile attack reduces the likelihood of unintended consequences, of unpredictable circumstances, to the point where they may find it somewhat acceptable. Were the president ordering a large-scale attack by manned aircraft, therefore posing the risk of American planes being shot down and pilots captured, it becomes a different story. Were the president proposing to send in special operations forces to locate chemical weapons stores and to destroy them, that would carry a far greater risk and more uncertainty. So I think one of the things that the president's doing here in the design of this operation, which again I think he's pursuing for domestic political reasons, but he's sort of ensuring that the design is such that the possibility of an untoward outcome and greater complications is considerably reduced. And I'm not saying that because I'm sticking up for it. I think this is a dunderheaded idea, but they're undertaking the operation in a very conservative way in order to try to minimize the likelihood of bad surprises.
Well, but even if it is surgical, which is, I think, next to impossible, it's very likely that the Assad regime will use it as a propaganda platform and even stage stuff to make it look like how terrible the Americans are. I mean, that's just the nature of this regime.
Well, I think more than that, it's the nature of U.S. relations in the Islamic world that there's going to be considerable outrage. Now, here go the Americans again.
Right.
Intervening in that part of the world, killing Arabs, killing Muslims, almost necessarily, and yes, to some degree, Assad will try to use that as a propaganda victory. And regardless of what Assad does, just the actions taken at face value are going to breed further anti-Americanism in a part of the world where anti-Americanism is already rampant.
Well, Colonel Bacevich, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired U.S. Army colonel and currently a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. His books include American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War, The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, and his latest book, Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. He has an article at BillMoyers.com, Questions for President Obama Before He Pulls the Trigger on Syria. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at IanMasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.